Thank you, Sean. Appreciate your good efforts in leading us this evening. It's a very difficult task to lead singing, and I appreciate those who get up and do their best and certainly make a difference. I appreciate it. But it's been good to be here. It's been good to worship with all the men who have led us thus far and to be with you. Very grateful for you, friends. Really am. We looked at last month a couple of lessons on love and how love is just so important. And to remind us of the significance of love, I go back to this great text in 1 Corinthians 13, where Paul just sets the stage in letting the brethren know, you need this. You need to love one another. That though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I become sounding brass or a clanging cymbal. And we observe the fact that whatever language the angels speak, man will never speak, obviously in this life especially. And they had different gifts of tongues at this time, of languages of the earth, but nobody had the gift of tongue of angels. And no one could speak the language that the angels use in heaven. But Paul's saying, even if I had that, if I had something as rare as that, and yet I do not love, then it's meaningless, it's useless. It's like sounding brass or a clanging cymbal. Though I have the gift of prophecy, in verse 2, and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith, so that I could remove mountains, but have not love, I'm nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, but have not love, it profits me nothing. Now, if you sold everything tonight to give to the poor, and yet you and I fail to love one another or fail to remain committed to one another, that sale was useless. It was meaningless if there's not a continued devotion to one another in love. Another good way of seeing this is in Peter. We see on several occasions that Peter physically suffered as an apostle. He was beaten. He was placed in jail. The man was doing his best to preach the gospel and accept the earthly consequences of that. But there was a time in Peter's life when Paul had to rebuke him for being a hypocrite, for giving in to racism. And Paul rebuked him in Galatians 2, verses 11 through 13, and told him he had to repent. Now, what that shows us is that the sacrifices Peter made early on, this physical torture he endured as an apostle, those sacrifices were meaningless if he did not love his brethren, if he did not exercise that devotion, that impartial love to his brethren, especially at Antioch. That without love, the sacrifices were insignificant. So in order for those things to still have meaning, those sacrifices, and still have relevance in his example as an apostle and as a Christian, he had to be a person committed to love. You cannot live a Christian life without loving one another. I can't go to heaven unless I love you. You can't go unless you love me. It's that serious. Love is not, it's not optional. It's not like saying, well, I'll make up for it somewhere else. I'll give a little bit more on the plate next week, or I'll do an extra good deed for someone else down the road, but I will not love her. I will not love. That's not optional. It's not like we can refuse to have each other's best interest at heart and still go to heaven. In 1 John chapter 3 and verse 10, here's how you tell the children of devil and the children of God apart. Whoever does not practice righteousness is not of God, nor is he who does not love his brother. Do you love me? Do I love you? Is there anyone in this congregation, or frankly, anyone in your life, especially as Christians, that you just don't love? Well, these verses say that you cannot go to heaven unless you love your brother. It's that important. Love is that serious. And that's why the Corinthians had to correct this. They needed a chapter on love. They needed an exhortation on love, as Paul wrote them in 1 Corinthians 13, because they were missing what it was all about. that instead of competing carnally with one another for these spiritual gifts and fighting over these things or mistreating one another or seeking personal gain, in 1 Corinthians 14, they needed to hear about love. And that's why Paul ended chapter 12 by saying, I earnestly desire the best gifts, and yet I show you a more excellent way. I've got a much better plan for you than all this fighting and division and bitterness that was eating up the church there at Corinth. And so I want to conclude this mini-series on loving one another with this third lesson. And it's a examination of what is specifically said in 1 Corinthians chapter 13 in verses 7 and 8. As he's already gone through this great list of how we need to be people who suffer long and we're kind and we don't envy, we're not puffed up, we're not rude, we don't think evil, we don't rejoice in iniquity, but rejoice in truth. But then he says in verse 7 that love bears all things, love believes all things, love hopes all things, love endures all things, love never fails. When you look more closely at these principles, when he says that love bears all things, he's suggesting the idea of how love comes to the protection of one another. That it is a commitment to not betray one another, to sustain one another. I thought of what it says in 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 8. And how well does this tie in with this morning's lesson on covering sin? He says in 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 8, above all things, have fervent love for one another, for love will cover a multitude of sins. What do you think he's talking about there? And obviously, I believe he's talking about how our commitment to one another is so strong that we want to help each other get past sin. We want to help each other rise above our failures, rise above our shortcomings as Christians. It's a commitment to get each other to heaven. And it bears all things along the way, knowing that life is not going to be easy, knowing that you are going to suffer in life, you're going to struggle in life, and I'm going to struggle in life. And so I'm to be a person who's mindful of that. When a Christian's overtaken in sin, love comes to the rescue. That pride sits on the, you know, the sidelines and points fingers and mocks and rejoices in iniquity. But it says in Galatians chapter 6 and verses 1 and 2 that, brethren, if a man is overtaken in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness, considering yourself, lest you also be tempted. Bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. He wants us to be people who are committed. And when he says that we are to be people who are spiritual and to restore that person in a spirit of gentleness, it's the idea of encouraging one another to endure and to not give up. That we go to that person who's overcome with sin and we remind them of our love for them and God's love for them and how they can rise above their sin and they should rise above their sin and how they're still so important to the cause of Christ. Johnny mentioned in his comments this morning about the need to remember our veterans, and that's a good thought. I came across a really fascinating story about a POW in Vietnam. His name was Colonel Laird Gunnert, who passed away in 2006. But here's a man who was beaten mercilessly while he was a captive. And his interrogators would force him to kneel for hours at a time. And one day, his captors took him to this interrogation room that he had never been before. And this time, the beating was real severe. I mean, he was really having it handed to him. And so, when the beating was over, he was there laying on the floor. And as he's there on the floor in much pain, too exhausted and too battered to even lift his face from the dirt floor, he saw something on the wall about 4 inches off the floor. And it was right in front of his face. And as his eyes focused, he saw that someone had scrawled in the dirt two words, "Not alone." And he said that was enough to inspire him to endure, to press on, to not give up. You're not alone. Two words. You're not alone. I'm getting beaten with you. I'm struggling with you. I've gone through this just like you have. You're not alone. And that's exactly what Paul is saying in Galatians chapter 6. When you see someone overcome with sin, you go to them in a spirit of gentleness and say, I know what you're going through. I know what it's like to struggle with sin. And you can rise above this. Why would we do that? It's because we love one another. We bear all things and we're willing to put away the past. It says in Proverbs chapter 10 and verse 12, and talking about covering up sin with love. Hatred stirs up strife, but love covers all sins. Let's rise above our mistakes. Let's rise above our shortcomings. Let's not wallow in the past. That's hard to do, but that's what love does. Love bears all things. Love believes all things, is what we read. Now, what I believe he's talking about is the idea of having confidence in someone. That I believe you'll do the right thing. That's what love is suggesting. I know you're a better person. I know you can do the right thing, is what it means. And I read that, and I thought of other times when Paul demonstrated this belief in people. I think of what he said to Philemon in Philemon 21, when he was making this tremendous request to Philemon to show mercy on this slave who ran away and became a Christian. But he says in Philemon, in verse 21, having confidence in your obedience, I write to you, knowing that you will do even more than I say. What a thought that was. I believe in you, Philemon. I know I'm asking a lot of you, but I know you're a good man. I know you're a man who will do the right thing. That's what love is. It believes the best in one another. 2 Corinthians chapter 2, we see Paul using this very same sentiment again. 2 Corinthians chapter 2, he says in verse 3, and I wrote this very thing to you, lest when I came I should have sorrow over those from whom I ought to have joy, having confidence in you all, that my joy is the joy of you all. I believe in you, brethren. I believe in you, Corinthians, to do the right thing. 2 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 16. Therefore I rejoice that I have confidence in you in everything. There are power in words, real power, in letting people know that we believe they can do the right thing and will do the right thing. I believe in you. I read of a study that the psychologists put together. And the purpose of the study was to see how much pain people could endure. And for this particular test, they used buckets of ice water. And they had people put their bare feet in these buckets to see how long they could endure this. And they noticed that there was one thing that made the biggest difference in how long people could endure this. And the one thing that made the difference between people who just couldn't take much of it versus those who could endure twice as long even, and the only difference was encouragement. The group that endured twice as long had people cheering them on, had people encouraging them to press on, and it made a real difference to these people. Now, if that's the case in enduring pain to pass a test, what about the test of life? What about the struggle in going to heaven, in offering a word to one another? I believe in you. I don't think these were empty promises that Paul made Philemon or the Corinthians. I think he was sincerely convinced these people were good. They wanted to do the right thing, and he let them know that. Your children need to hear that. Your spouse needs to hear that. Your brethren need to hear that. I believe in you. I have confidence in you. Love believes all things. Love hopes all things. And what this means, in contrast to what we just made, is the fact that you hope that the bad things you hear about one another are not true. You really hope that that person has done the right thing despite what is being said about them. I hope it's not true. When I hear something bad about fellow Christians, I hope it's not true. I want to believe they did the right thing. In Luke chapter 22, notice how Jesus used this expression in Luke 22 when he was dealing with people. He said to Peter in Luke 22 in verses 31 and 32, the Lord said, "Simon, Simon, indeed Satan has asked for you that he may sift you as wheat, but I have prayed for you that your faith should not fail, and when you have returned to me, strengthen your brethren." I know you're going to do the right thing. I know you're going to return and do the right thing. You hope all things. You hope the best in people. Words are powerful. You just cannot. I have read accounts of where people decided not to commit suicide simply because of some encouragement they received from a family member or some other person in life. Words are real. They're real things. This preacher told the story of this banker who would pass a man on the streets every day who was a legless man and a beggar. And he tried to provide for himself by selling pencils every day. And this banker would walk by all the time. And he would buy a pencil every time. But he'd also tell this man, "You're a great businessman. Great businessman." And he would offer that encouragement to this man every day as he got a pencil. And this would go on for a long period of time. Well, the banker was walking the street one day and he noticed the man was gone. Went back the next day, the man was gone. Weeks go by, didn't see the man, thought it was, you know, the end of his encounter with this man. But the banker went to a public building, and in this public building was this group of stores and businesses, and there was a concession stand. And in that concession stand was this legless man operating his own business. And when he saw the banker, he waved him over and he said, "I was hoping you would come in here one day because I wanted you to know that this was a result of you. That you kept telling me I was such a great businessman that I actually believed it. And it inspired me to keep going and open this store." Words are powerful. Words are real. And when Jesus is telling Peter, "I know you'll return to me. I know you'll do the right thing," he was encouraging him. And I have to let my family know that. I have to let you know that. I believe in you. I hope the best in you. In Proverbs chapter 18, in verses 13 and 17, that we have to be people who hold out for the best story, who hold out for the truth, and we want the truth to be that of a Christian who's doing the right thing. In Hebrews chapter 18 it says, in verse 13 and verse 17 it says, "He who answers a matter before he hears it, it is folly and shame to him. The first one," in verse 17, "to plead his cause seems right until his neighbor comes and examines him." You're going to hear dirt on your fellow Christian. I'm going to hear dirt on you. But love holds out. Love hopes that that dirt is not real. Love wants to encourage each other to rise above sin. But most importantly, friends, as he says, love never fails. This one's really important because love never gives up on one another. Let me ask it this way. Is there anything your child can do to where you will not love that child? I think most of us would say, if our love is healthy, that there's nothing our child can do where we would not love our children. We understand that. But what about your spouse? Is there anything your spouse can do to where you will stop loving them? Well, it can, but if our love is healthy, Tom's shaking his head no, and that's a really good response, brother, and I think he's right on that. No, we're always going to love our spouse, no matter what. But what about your brethren? Are we committed to one another to the point that there is nothing you can do to where I won't love you? Do you realize that in some places and possibly even here, some churches and some relationships within churches are one bad comment away from falling apart? One bad comment. And brethren, stop loving one another. Start coexisting. Stop coexisting together as a group. One statement, and that love ends. Well, Paul's saying here, love does not end. When love is healthy like it should be, there is nothing you can do to where I will not love you. I will not do what's right and good and upright toward you. I can't do that. Well, actually you can. Jesus shows us in Luke chapter 23 that it's possible for love to never end because he demonstrates this. As these people are taking his life from him, it says that Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do." How in the world could Jesus do that? People are taking his life. They falsely accused him. And yet he's demonstrating, there is nothing these people can do to where I won't stop loving them. I won't stop wanting what's best for them. And if Jesus could do that to the people taking his life away, can I not do that for you? There is nothing, it should be, there's nothing you can do to where I won't be committed to you to make this thing work. That's when marriages are a success, when people are so committed to overcome the hard times and the failures. And so it should be in our relationship with one another. There is nothing, nothing you can say, there is nothing you can do to me to where I will not pray for the best outcome in your soul and in my relationship with you. In Matthew chapter 18, notice where it says in verses 21 and 22. This is how committed love needs to be. In Matthew chapter 18, it says in verses 21 and 22. Peter came to Jesus and said, "Lord, how often shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Up to seven times?" Jesus said to him, "I do not say up to seven times, but up to 70 times seven." Now, what does that mean? We understand what he's talking about is not a number, but it's a commitment. It's a devotion. It's a belief. It's an outlook. It's a realization. You can sin against me seven times 70 in a day, and I'll still love you, is the type of love Jesus wants us to have for one another. Do you love me? Do I love you? Do you love one another? That's the significance of all that we're looking at. Because without this love, we cannot know God, because God is love. And so the love that we're to have is not just a relationship that's going to fall apart at the first ill experience or disappointment, but rather it's the commitment that says, "I'm hurting, but I love you, and I'm committed to make this work. And I'm going to show you love regardless of how you treat me." In Ephesians chapter 4, it says in verses 31 and 32, "Let all bitterness, wrath, anger, clamor, and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice. Be kind to one another, tenderhearted, forgiving one another, even as God in Christ forgave you." Now, from my experience, I need mercy from God. All the time I need mercy because I make so many bad mistakes in life. And if God only loved me for the moment, or he only loved me when he felt like it, he would never offer me the mercy that I need. But he is a God who forgives and keeps forgiving and keeps encouraging me to rise above my sin because he genuinely loves me, and he has that for you. And what these verses are saying is you have to have that for one another. If you want to understand me, you have to have this type of commitment to one another. That's why Paul's saying, look, brethren, we're not even on the same page here. When you're fighting with one another for these spiritual gifts and dividing over various things at church, you're on the wrong page. I'm going to show you a much better way, a more excellent way. And it's by emptying yourself and becoming more like God. And so I wanted to share these thoughts because they're just so important and they need to be reviewed from time to time because we all struggle with love. But it's such an important, beautiful message that I think we can continue in as a group. This is a very loving group. It really is. But you know as well as I do, there's going to be times of disappointment. I'm committed, and you need to be committed. to one another, as especially we are committed to the Lord. Could be that you're here and you're not a child of God. We love you, and we want you to know God loves you much more than we do, and He wants you to be saved from sin. And we are concerned about you, and so we ask you to think about that and be ready to obey the gospel as it's described in the New Testament. Here are the beautiful passages that describe this process. And if you're ready to do that, we encourage you to do that tonight. But if you need to come back and make things right with God, know that you're surrounded by people who understand you're not alone. You're not alone in the struggle with sin. And we love you, and we'll pray for you as we stand and sing.